Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi everybody, welcome to Dan Snow's History Hit. We're working our way through the last days of August here in 2020. And our thoughts are turning to the autumn, to the fall. We've got a lot going on, everybody. We've got the ongoing struggles with COVID. We're going to have economic and political dislocation. We have the US presidential election. It's all happening. And as ever, History Hit will be your guide. We've got some big plans. We've got lots and lots of programs, lots of podcasts in commission talking about things like rebuilding the economy after the First World War and the Spanish influenza. We're going to be focusing a lot on the US presidential election. What is the Electoral College? What has happened in previous close elections that have been contested? We're also making some great documentaries. It's the 400th anniversary of the Mayflower departing the UK. We're talking to descendants of the settlers, historians. We're also talking to descendants of the Aboriginal American tribe that they encountered. We've got the 80th anniversary of the Battle of Britain, a big program planned for that. So it's all happening. So please go and check out historyhit.tv. It's the new Netflix for history and limited history documentaries. Well, limited, but you'll never get through them realistically. I mean, you'd have to defeat sleep entirely. Use the code POD1, P-O-D-1, you get a month for free. Check it all out. Don't like it? Don't subscribe. I'm cool with that. And then you get your second month for just £1, euro or dollar. This podcast is a kind of late August podcast talking about the restaurant. The fascinating story of how we've gone out to eat from the Romans to the present day. We're talking to William Sitwell. He's the restaurant critic for the Daily Telegraph here in the UK. He eats for free and then writes funny things about the restaurant and the food. I mean, outrageous, to be honest, but good luck to him. He's written a book now, History of the Restaurant, and he's got some interesting observations about how and why we choose to spend our money eating out. From Pompeii to US counterculture in the 1960s. Enjoy. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Well, thank you, Dan. Thanks for asking me.
This is a heck of a time to be talking about the history of restaurants because this will get a chapter in future histories. Every restaurant on the planet suddenly closed. I mean, that's not good.
Well, someone said to me that the publication of my book was either the worst possible timing you could imagine or just extraordinarily clever because you could then, you know, have the vicarious pleasure of reading and thinking about restaurants. But it's certainly true that when my book came out, lockdown was well and truly, among us. And every restaurant in the country, if not the entire world, was shut. So there has not been a time in history when that's happened. I mean, emperors, kings have tried to shut taverns and coffee houses in the past. No one has done it quite successfully as our current rulers.
No, I mean, that exactly. It's comprehensive. And it's also, but you, as you say, reading your book and being in lockdown, I mean, I can't wait to get crowded around a little table where there's too many of us for the table and someone just whacks a jug of house wine down the middle and we just start chatting and eating. I can't wait.
But, you know, it is already happening. I went to, my column for The Telegraph has started again in earnest, which is very exciting. And there seems to be a contrast between some restaurants that have redesigned themselves to look like, you know, wards in a hospital, where every member of staff is shielded behind a mask and a visor, where there are perspex divides between tables, where your temperature is tested. And there are a lot of those places. There's a wonderful restaurant down in Suffolk called The Unruly Pig, where they do all of that. But then I went to a restaurant in Bridport called the Station Kitchen. The bar and the kitchen are in the old Bridport Station Master's ticket office and hall, And the restaurant is in an old train carriage that actually used to ferry wounded soldiers to hospitals during the First World War. There was absolutely no sign of any masks. We were all sitting in the carriage, eating merrily. I mean, you know, we were on tables for two and there were other tables for four and six, but it was like normal times and it made me quite happy. So I think it depends on the restaurateur. I think people want to reassure the punters that they're going to be safe, but also I think punters want normality. And as you say, I'm almost yearning to have someone spill wine down me and apologize. You know, we want to bump into people. I mean, half the fun is, it almost sounds like, you know, a myth, the idea of standing at a bar waving a note to try and get someone's attention. You know, I dream of the time when I can't get the waiter's attention to get a bill, you know, because there's so many people in there. Hospitality is about hustle and bustle, and it's about atmosphere. It doesn't matter how wonderful the food is in a restaurant. It doesn't matter how great the service is. You know, if there's no atmosphere, you know, you go out to, you know, eating out is fun. Okay, it's there for business, but you need to have a good time. And if you can't do that, if you feel you're going to the ward of your local hospital, it sort of loses its reason, and people will just stay at home merrily as they have been.
Exactly. Now, you have cited two examples there. Like, a lot of people say to me, oh, you've got the best job in the world because I get to go and meet veterans and go around battlefields. But you get to go around the country. You self-select. You get to go and eat amazing food and drink lots of booze for free. And then write witty things about it. And annoyingly, we're just talking on Zoom. You're very thin. You're not paunchy. Your skin is good. You know, you don't look like you're about to die of gout. You're obviously very lucky. Does the history fascinate you as much as actually doing it in the flesh? Does the history matter? Does the history of restaurants matter?
I think the history of restaurants does matter. And I love exploring the development of hospitality. Your first point about having a lovely job. I mean, I took my two elder teenage kids to a restaurant. I hadn't seen them for a few weeks. And we went on a review and we did agree that this is quite a nice way of for their dad to earn a living. You know, sniffing the wine, thinking about it, looking at the menu, ordering lobster. I mean, you know, when lockdown began, I felt that I was sort of, there was so much cholesterol in my veins. I'd sort of overeaten. I was quite looking forward to a period of sort of fasting. But I did miss it, and it's lovely to get out there. But it's not just the joy of dining out. I do love meeting chefs. I do love discussing food with people who are passionate about it. And what I love about the subject of food is that if you don't care or you do care, I find that fascinating. It's a doorway into people's culture. People who say they have no interest, I just find that extraordinary. And you can drill down and realize actually that they do. So it's the most phenomenal subject because it's about politics and culture and happiness and misery and poverty. And of course, the history. And one of the things that I love about the history of restaurants is, well, two things, which are sort of quite contrasting. One is the extraordinary change and advancement and the story of restaurants that goes to such an extreme that it's about not being hungry. It's about theatre. But then also the story of restaurants is about a total lack of change. If you go back to, you know, back into ancient history, back to Pompeii, AD 79, the hospitality that was thriving in that extraordinarily fashionable Roman Empire city shows that, you know, if you'd gone into the streets, if you'd walked up the main drag, the Via della Abbondanza, and gone into a tavern, you would have felt a very familiar scenario. So I love the idea that in many ways nothing has changed, but I love the fact that in many ways, you know, they weren't sous-viding back in those days. You know, they weren't creating froths and smears and carpaccios of this and et cetera, et cetera. But I'm sure there were elements of dining out as theatre as well, probably more unsavoury. But
so you identify Pompeii is important, Rome's important. And then we don't. It seems that the kind of restaurants and pubs and things become a bit more. It's slightly more difficult to place. And then there's a sort of explosion in the late Middle Ages. So just kind of can you give me the global history of eating out? What have you learned from the book?
Well, let me tell you, there's a global mystery, Dan, which is what on earth happened between sort of, I don't know, AD 79, demise of Pompeii, and the early 15th century in London, where restaurants sort of started to emerge, really to sort of support the burgeoning parliament and the civil servants that were kind of clustering around Westminster. You know, what on earth, what happened? Because there seemed to have been no development for hundreds and hundreds of years. The Romans were so sophisticated. Hospitality was a law, really. You know, when you travelled in the Roman Empire, you were expected to give and receive hospitality. And then the Roman Empire sort of the Roman Empire falls, and hospitality seems to disappear with it. But I suppose the story of eating out is a story of characters and innovation. And there are moments that, for me, do start to flag up, you know, real change. There's a big debate about the impact of the French Revolution on dining, because at the end of the French Revolution, so the sort of turn of the, you know, 18th century, there were some 500 more restaurants in Paris than there were at the beginning. And it's not a coincidence. And one of the reasons, and people do debate this, but I think there is a truth in it. The revolutionaries, Robespierre, you know, they set about chopping off the heads of the aristocrats. And they all lived in this extraordinary grandeur in their vast chateaus and their enormous apartments in Paris. And you chopped off their heads, and it meant that they had a lot of staff without jobs. And those staff, a lot of them went to Paris and started to open kitchens, and they did run restaurants. Now, not all of them were successful at running restaurants. There was Marie Antoinette's personal private chef actually complained to the government, the revolutionaries, that he'd lost his job and wanted back pay. Anyway, he was executed. So that wasn't a very sensible protest of his. But there was definitely this idea, you know, there was a new bourgeoisie and they wanted to dine out. And certainly the French Revolution was a bit of a catalyst. But, you know, the story of restaurants is one that sort of ebbs and flows across the centuries. And as technology improves and travel improves, you see the sort of the tentacles of inspiration appearing in extraordinary places, and trends begin and they sort of dissipate. So, you know, it's hard to encapsulate and answer your question simply because it's such a vast story.
And what about drinking? I mean, are you somebody, do restaurants revolve around food, or do pubs and alehouses feature? Because, you know, Britain in particular, it feels like the delivery of alcohol to the public just feels like such an important part of our national story.
Yeah, it is. And obviously, you know, historically there was a lot of worry about the gin craze, because British labourers, it seemed, were quite happy to sort of spend all their money at the end of the week on gin. And the development of working class, working men's clubs was sort of hijacked by people who saw them as places where working men could gather and be educated and not drink. Certainly, you know, the story of drink is a fascinating topic. As we get enveloped by it, we love it, and we fall in love with it, we fall out of love with it. Those who wish to rule us wish we weren't drinking as much as we do. I mean, I think it is a very peculiarly English story, our love and our obsession with booze. You know, the French, the Italians are able to have a 7-hour lunch and not stagger out and throw up and be completely wasted. Whereas, you know, 7 hours, a British 7-hour lunch is a massive sort of drinkathon. So there are cultural differences about drinking. But I think certainly the British story of restaurants does also hinge on the story of booze and, you know, taverns and inns and so on. But I think really, you know, our food story was sort of punctured. We had bad times in the Victorian era, partly, I think, because the Victorians didn't really agree with the idea of pleasure. You know, I think the Victorians wanted to ban puddings, basically. And the Second World War, with rationing, also stalled the advance of British food culture. It brought out that inner Puritan Victorian character in the British, because we were very happy to be rationed. And we remained rationed for 7 years after the war. And subsequent generations, I think, felt that they wanted to indoctrinate their children with the rationing that they'd tolerated. And so the British food story doesn't really get going until people like Elizabeth David write about food in a romantic way, until the end of the 60s, where, you know, the wonderful Roux brothers turn up into London and start to open restaurants and demonstrate how wonderful food can be and how great service can be. It ebbs and flows.
I'm Professor Susanna Lipscomb, and on Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, I'm looking for answers to the big questions about every aspect of life in the early modern period. Like, how did the memory of Anne Boleyn continue to influence the court of her daughter, Elizabeth I? How were fairies brought to life on the Elizabethan stage? And how did the arrival of male-only doctors threaten the lives of women? In other words, not just the Tudors, but most definitely also the Tudors. Twice a week, every week. Subscribe now and follow me on Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura frames are beautiful, Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. And also remember, when you use a messaging app, they shrink the photos. You cannot print those out. You cannot blow them up. This is high quality imagery going to one of the most important people in your life. The Aura app is super easy to set up. It takes about 2 minutes and you're going to love it. There's free unlimited storage. Add unlimited photos and videos and invite as many people as you want to a frame. Right now, Aura has got a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting auraframes.com to get $30 plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AURAframes.com. Use code DANSNOW at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
I mean, with the exception of Rome, restaurants as we understand today, going somewhere, being waited on at a table, having a menu, it's so funny because it's so ubiquitous, and yet it's quite new, really. It's only a couple hundred years old.
It is relatively new, and I think that if you speak to, you know, I'm 50. You speak to my parents' generation, their parents, what my grandparents, eating out was a huge luxury, you know, pre-lockdown. This, you know, if you went into, you know, 2020, our grandparents, great-grandparents wouldn't have recognised how young people are able to eat out so regularly and so freely and relatively so cheaply. So the idea of eating out as a kind of hobby, that restaurant going is a sort of daily enterprise, would be completely, totally anathema to previous generations. Ironically, it was the Second World War that saw Britain eating out as never before because of the British restaurant. The the sort of national network of canteens that Lord Woolton, the Minister of Food, set up, saw cafes that could produce food that was on the ration. It meant that families who'd had their houses bombed or had lost their kitchens, people could go and eat the ration and eat cheaply and eat not just economically, but generally a healthy diet using what was available. So Britain ate out in the Second World War more than they had ever done in history. But you're quite right. The idea of, you know, restaurants being available to everybody is a relatively new phenomenon.
The French loom very large in this story, not just the revolution, but it strikes me that so many of the words we're using, every time you go into there's a shadow of our sort of love-hate relationship with the French sort of seems to fall across every restaurant experience I have. Or maybe that's just my overactive 18th century love of history.
No, the French have certainly been very dominant, and in many ways they remain dominant. What annoys the French, though, is the fact that Catherine de' Medici, when she came over from Italy from Venice, Florence, wherever it was she was living back in the day, and brought her entourage with her. She married, you know, the young French king, was married by the Pope. People say that she brought Italian gastronomy to France, and that's what really got the French going. So the origins of French gastronomy lay in with the Medicis. So the Italians can really say that they were producing proper posh food and things like zabaglione long before the French were. But the French don't really like that idea. What the French did, though, particularly in this sort of mid-19th century, with people like Carême, was to formalise restaurants and restaurant menus, formalise kitchens, organise kitchens in, you know, proper brigades, almost sort of army style. And they formalised and created sort of clear space between the amateur kitchen, the home kitchen, and the professional kitchen. And so the French influence is obviously immense and extraordinary and remains to this day. And as I touched on earlier, I think that a lot of chefs today, even if they don't know it in this country, owe a great deal to the Roux brothers, because they saw this opportunity. They came into what was still a fairly bleak scene post-war, still by the late 1960s, early 70s. You know, the restaurant scene was not really worth describing, with a few rare examples in places like Oxford and some in London. But they saw this opportunity. You know, they were entrepreneurs. Michel and his brother Albert worked for private families. Albert was working for the Cazalet family in England. Michel was working for the Rothschilds in Paris. And when Michel came to stay with his brother Albert in the summer in Kent, they would go up to London and merrily eat in these terrible restaurants. And they saw there was an opportunity that they could create food that, and restaurants create a scene that was just not available. But what they did was they trained a lot of young chefs. There was a new generation of chefs, people like Marco Pierre White and people like Roly Lee, and so on, who then went on to create their own restaurants and inspire future generations. But also they put the idea of service as a profession on the map, you know. And I think people like Diego Mazziega, who worked at the Gavroche for 30 years, you know, showed young Brits that actually serving in restaurants was a viable and a profession to be proud of. So the French are still having their influence today. But, you know, trends move on and different, you know, scenarios emerge. Michelin these days, which obviously is a French organization, it's a tire company with very ambitious marketing aims. Wherever they do guides, they're trying to sell tires. And that is essentially French. But so that they can stay relevant, they don't just salute and flag up, you know, places that adhere to the roots of classic French gastronomy. You know, you get stars for little holes in the wall, pubs, and so on. But the tentacles and the influence of the French I don't think will ever go away.
The Japanese sushi guy in the underground station in Tokyo with the Michelin star. Enjoy that one. It's interesting, the Roux's journey, though, from private sort of aristocratic families to pub. It does feel to me like with restaurants, as with so many other sporting and cultural pursuits in the 19th century, it goes from like giving the bourgeois, the new urban sort of middle class, a taste of what it's like to be a toff, because you build a nice restaurant with some gilded, you know, wood carvings and some mirrors and some chandeliers, and then you stick lots of us in there and we all get to eat the food the toffs eat. I mean, is that something that's going on in the 19th century as this new mass of people have money to spend?
Yeah, it's interesting that, and it is true, because in exactly the same way as those redundant chefs from the aristocrats from the French Revolution were starting up restaurants and creating ornate places where people could dine as if they were toffs, that's exactly what the Roux brothers were doing. They were working for wealthy families and they decided to create restaurants that, again, would reflect that. The origins of clubs, gentlemen's clubs, created in London to mirror the stately homes, the drawing rooms and the libraries of the rich aristocrats in the countryside who might not have had posh London houses, those were created so that the toffs could feel at home. So, yes, it's absolutely a thread throughout history of, you know, the plebs finally getting a taste of what the posh people are doing thanks to the chefs. And I think the huge change that we've seen in the last sort of 20, 30 years is an abandonment of that. And you've got young, you know, foodie entrepreneurs creating restaurants in shipping containers, such as Will Bowlby's Cricket. You've got people taking advantage of this street food scene, you know, in parts of East London, people realizing that you can create a stall to create food culture. You don't need bricks and mortar. The idea that you can begin a food business by having a YouTube channel or an Instagram account. This is a new way of developing and bringing ideas to the fore that absolutely gets rid of this sort of hangover of, you know, posh food for the rest of us, thanks to the chef who's managed to slip out of the gilded chateau or you know, stately home.
But that's the interesting for me about restaurants, and that is a bit different to ale. Well, anyway, the thing I find interesting about restaurants is your poor restaurant entrepreneurs. I admire them, because you've got the food to organise, but you've also got the vibe to sort out, and so they've got the ship, whether it's a shipping container or one of those lovely sort of 19th century restaurants where, again, you're trying to pretend that you've been invited to the dining room of a stately home, and you're riding two very different horses in a way, aren't you? Because you can have great food but terrible atmos. Then people like you come around and just rip them to pieces for it. I mean, from the beginning, there's been a theatricality to restaurants, hasn't there?
Being a successful restaurateur is one of the most difficult tasks that I can imagine, because you've got to be a creative. You've got to be a designer. You've got to have a sort of philosophy in terms of an approach to how you cook. You've got to be a businessman, because you've got to do the numbers. You've got to be a manager of people. So you've got to be, you know, have those sort of diplomatic skills. And it helps if you can actually cook a plate of food. You've got to be able to find the right crockery and the chemistry between, you know, crockery and decor. And you've got to do all those sorts of things. Then you've got to get people in there. You've got to be consistent, which is the hardest thing. That's why Michelin stars, the pressure of it gets to people, because it's not just the fact that you can cook a beautiful plate of food, you know, one day. You've got to do it the next day, the next day, the next day, every day, for days, months, years. And then you've got to tolerate people like me turning up and having a sniff around and bashing out hilarious copy as sport. Although I would say, Dan, I think there, you know, some of the, I'm not one, I take huge pleasure in finding gems and writing good reviews. And I find actually writing good reviews is much harder than sticking the knife in, even though I wouldn't say that it's not enjoyable and it does need to be done occasionally. But there's far greater pleasure for me, and I promise you, I mean it, there's far greater pleasure for me from writing a great review, because because the positive impact of a great review is far greater than the negative one of a terrible review. So yeah, you've got to deal with all this stuff, and then you've got to deal with flack from critics. And then imagine you've done all that, and then a plague turns up and shuts you down anyway. I mean, it's this extraordinary profession, but it does bring in some of the most creative people and the most passionate people, which is why I love the subject of food.
Well, I like the subject of it. I also like the consuming of it. It is very difficult, but when they get it right, it's a glorious thing. So listen, we don't usually do this on this podcast. Tell us what the book's called, first of all.
My book is called The Restaurant, A History of Eating Out.
Where are your favourite spots to go at the moment? Because we've got listeners all over the world, but obviously lots here in the UK. Where, I mean, you've named a couple of great ones in the UK, but anywhere that we should be checking out in the UK at the moment?
I had a wonderful, very good curry at Sea Spice in Aldbury the other day on the Suffolk coast. I mentioned the Station Kitchen in Bridport, wonderful little place, very good lobster there. I had a fantastic lunch at Sam's Riverside, which is a restaurant run by a guy who trained under Rick Stein. That's in Hammersmith. If you're in Soho, I love Quo Vadis. Jeremy Lee, Scottish chef, absolutely brilliant. If you're down in the Southwest, check out Hicks, Mark Hicks, who's got his oyster and fish house in Lyme Regis.
Anywhere in the frozen north?
Up in the north. Let me think. I'm about to head to Aberdeenshire, and there's a place that sells lobster up in Bamborough. I think it's called the Potted Lobster. I'm looking forward to eating there.
And then, do you venture abroad for your column? Are you allowed? Do they send you abroad? To any North American suggestions for our audience over there?
I'm going to have to let you down. My column, I have a tight leash. If only I could eat my way around the world, then I really would have the greatest job. But then I probably wouldn't be able to get into an aeroplane because I wouldn't fit in the seats.
I mean, is it even possible to sort of to make a difference, differentiate between atmosphere and food in a restaurant? I mean, are there restaurants where the food is average, but you just love the atmos and you'd go back and back?
Oh, totally. I mean, if the food is the most important thing, I think you're going out for the wrong reasons. It's rather like, you know, you go and see a great comedian, and you say the next day, oh, you know, Michael McIntyre or whoever, and you know, Billy Connolly, and you talk about how you'd never laugh so much in your life, but you can't remember any of the jokes. It's a bit like a great meal out. You have a wonderful time. If you can't remember what it was you ate, it doesn't matter because you had a great time. You had great. The most important thing about going out is conversation and communing with your fellow humans. And food is there to help that, not to get in the way, which is why it's annoying if you're constantly being interrupted by someone asking you and, you know, pointing at the food, telling you about every ingredient on the plate, asking you if you enjoyed it, you know, where you have to keep on thanking the staff. Yes, thank you. That was great. Oh, wonderful. Thank you so much. We need to be left alone. I love to pour my own wine in restaurants. You know, I'm a grown up.
We want to have a good time. Wait, what's that? It's a primal scream lyric, isn't it? We want to have a good time. We want to get loaded. Anyway, enough of that. I go out on my speedboat and have fish and chips with the kids on the Isle of Wight. And frankly, they're the best restaurants on planet Earth. Thank you very much indeed for coming on the podcast.
Thanks, Dan. It's been really lovely chatting to you. Thank you.
Hi everyone, it's me, Dan Snow. Just a quick request. It's so annoying and I hate it when other podcasts do this, but now I'm doing it and I hate myself. Please, please go onto iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts, and give us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps, basically boosts up the chart, which is good. And then more people listen, which is nice. So if you could do that, I'd be very grateful. I understand if you don't subscribe to my TV channel. I understand if you don't buy my calendar, but this is free. Come on, do me a favor. Thanks.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History Hit. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.